I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at RAINnetwork.com.
Welcome to the RAIN Insights podcast from RAIN Network. In this podcast episode, David Lawrence, co-founder of RAIN, speaks with Dr. Fred Southwick about his new book, Playing with Bees, in which he provides both a patient and physician frontline perspective on the many flaws in the U.S. healthcare system and creates a blueprint for change. Dr. Southwick is an infectious disease specialist at the University of Florida's College of Medicine.
Fred, welcome. And I always say this with the podcasts we've done in the past, it's always a privilege and an honor to be able to speak to you, and obviously you and Dr. Lang have been incredible thought leaders throughout our period with COVID and helping to advise the broad network on infectious diseases and data and debunking the myths. But we're here today for another reason, I'll be the first to say that when you told me that this was something you were working on, I was amazed in terms of how you found time for it. But you have a wonderful, wonderful book entitled Playing with Bees, and the subtitle is, you know, the lessons learned concerning our healthcare system and how to improve it. And I thought we'd just sort of launch in, and maybe you can tell the audience a little bit about how you came to this idea to study bees and write a book and share the lessons that you were able to glean. And we'll just start with further context for our audience is that Fred has, first of all, he's extraordinarily humble, so I'll flesh this out. But one of Fred's areas of practice has always been about how to improve healthcare and how to improve the delivery of healthcare to people and the lessons that are learned and what we can learn from our mistakes as well as our successes. So in many respects, the book is a natural transition for you. But why don't you just take the floor, Fred, and give us the background and the context of, you know, how you came to undertake this project.
Right. Thank you, David. I really look forward to talking to you about this book. What started is actually in 1988, my former wife was hospitalized with a very unusual illness. And the doctors were very distracted, and they didn't pay attention to her complaints and thought she had a little clot in her legs, and they focused on the clot in her legs, when in reality she had a very severe, what's called penicillin-induced vasculitis. And she had a severe allergy to penicillin that caused her whole body to attack her nerves, her heart, all their blood vessels. And everybody was just sort of dumbfounded watching her deteriorate to the point that she ended up in the ICU with less than 10% chance of survival. Miraculously, one physician put it all together just at the nick of time and started high doses of corticosteroids, which reversed the inflammation, and she survived. Now, at the time, I was just furious. And I couldn't believe that my academic institution where I worked had ignored my wife's complaints and done and delayed her diagnosis to the point that she nearly died. So I wrote an article at the time, Who's Caring for Mary? And it was in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 1992. And I got incredible response to this article, to the point that I received 90 letters from physicians. Physicians never write letters. And they said, you know, I may have been guilty of this, you know, not paying attention. And I'll always, from here on, thanks to your article, I will focus on patient care much more than I have before. Or the other reply was, I had a family member that the same thing happened to. It was just terrible. And I can't believe that our health system can be so woefully deficient. Well, at the time, I thought this was a one in a million event. And no one at that time in 1990, 1980, late 80s, really thought there was any problem with healthcare. They thought healthcare was the highest caliber in the United States. And how dare I criticize the health system? Subsequently, in 2000, the Institute of Medicine wrote a big white paper called "The Air Is Human," pointing out that actually there were many deaths in healthcare as a consequence of preventable medical errors. They estimated somewhere between 45,000 and 120,000. And this also created a storm. A lot of people questioned these results, but in reality, it's now we know that medical errors is now the third leading cause of death in the United States, affecting, killing somewhere between 240 and 400,000 per year. So this was all in the background. I was continuing to work in infectious disease, but then in 2010, I decided, you know, I think for the last part of my career, I want to work on this quality and safety and see if I can make a difference, because we're not seeing big changes in the number of preventable deaths, and we're not seeing big changes in the number of errors that are occurring in our hospitals and our clinics. So I applied for a grant through the university and was funded to go to Harvard, to the Harvard Business School, as a fellow. And there I really went mostly to the business school to learn about teamwork, to learn about bringing about change, and also to learn about medical errors through the School of Public Health. I came back and I was revved up. I was really excited because I had all this new knowledge and I was going to make a difference in my university. Well, I was assigned a quality improvement project, and immediately everybody resisted my proposals, and I got repeatedly beat up, basically. And it reminded me, when I was a little kid, I remember in my grandmother's backyard, I was fascinated by bees, and there were honeysuckle bushes there, and hundreds of bees, and I would go out to examine the bees and get very excited about watching them, and I would try to grab them to look at them, and they would sting me. And this was innocent. I was just interested in the bee, and similarly, I was just very excited about improving patient care, and that was my motivation, and yet I was getting stung. And that's when I came up with the idea of playing with bees. So I took notes from 2010 to the present about all my efforts to bring about change in healthcare. And so the book is really about the challenge and why, from a personal standpoint, I think I can explain very clearly why we have been so slow in healthcare to improve our systems and to actually reduce the number of errors. So that's how I got started on this whole journey.
So it's great. I just want to rewind a little bit, Fred. You stated that basically medical hospital errors are the third leading cause of death in America?
That is correct. Now, not everybody agrees with that estimate, but a fair number in the quality and safety field do agree with that estimate.
Okay. But the point is, whether it's third or fifth or, you know, whatever it is, what I'm hearing you say is that it is a material factor.
Yes.
In whether patients live or they die.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so, as you embarked, it's interesting, and I don't want to get too metaphorical with you, but as a kid, you're playing with bees and you're getting stung. And now you're looking at the activity within the hives and the specific roles that bees play, and also the fact that I think you, if I remember the statistic, they Bees have been around for, what, 100 million years or 200 million years, some extraordinary.
Yes, their system, the honeybee system, has been developed over 100 million years.
Right.
And so as I began to write the book, I said, you know, I really want to know more about bees, honeybees. And I learned, I didn't realize prior to writing the book, how helpful the analogies and the system that the honeybee has created really gives us the guidance for improving our health systems, which also coordinate. A honeybee hive has approximately 80,000 bees. Well, a big health system has somewhere between 30 and 40,000 employees. So the magnitude of coordination is actually quite similar. So we can learn from the honeybee how to improve our coordination and improve patient care.
All right, so Fred, just unpacking this a little bit more. This is part of the continuum of your focus on quality and safety of patient care. And you see this ecosystem which has survived for over 100 million years, obviously refined itself. You're seeing basically a system of 80,000 bees, and you're drawing comparisons with major medical centers. And you're saying, okay, are there lessons here that are applicable and that, in fact, can be implemented to the healthcare system and how patients are cared for, all right? So let's start to review what some of your conclusions are with respect to the valuable lessons and what can be implemented.
Well, the primary purpose of a honeybee hive is to accumulate sufficient honey that will give the bees enough calories that they can survive the winter, because honeybees do not hibernate. They actually keep the nest warm and heated over the winter by their flight muscles, rapidly moving their flight muscles, generating heat. That takes a lot of calories. The beehive can maintain a temperature of over 50 degrees Fahrenheit even when it's minus 20 outside. So they are able to generate lots of heat, but that requires a large number of calories. Well, it's been estimated that it requires about 70 to 80 pounds of honey to survive the winter. And then energy required for searching for the honey and or searching for the pollen and the nectar to generate those calories, actually to create the honey, that takes another approximately 90 pounds of honey. So somewhere in the order of somewhere the 120, 130 pounds of honey is what needs to be accumulated in order for a beehive to survive. So this is a life and death issue. So if they aren't coordinating their searching for the pollen and the nectar, if they're not coordinating the storage, if everyone isn't doing their job, the honeybee hive will not survive. So they have, over 100 million years, they have developed a very effective system. And one of the first things is each worker bee knows exactly what they need to do. And they do it because it's genetically predetermined behaviorally how they're supposed to behave and what they're supposed to do. So there need to be no supervisors. There's no one over them. And actually, the honeybee, working bee, actually is in charge of the beehive. It is not the queen bee. The queen bee actually simply procreates and stays in one place, and the honeybees help her in that quest. So how does the honeybee coordinate? First of all, the behavior is set. But secondly, they're able to communicate extremely efficiently. And this is very important. Our health systems too often physicians and nurses are not communicating in an efficient way. And there needs to be a standard approach to communication, which the honeybee has. It's called the waggle dance, where they actually, when one scout bee finds a large source of nectar, they will actually fly back to the nest and they will do a dance where they point their tail toward the direction of this site. And then the duration of the dance gives the other bees an idea how far away it is. So they know where, what direction and how far to find that particular site. So, and this takes just a few seconds to communicate. So they are able to communicate very, very effectively. And if more than one scout bee does the same dance, that tells you that's a rich source. So if multiple bees come back and say, you know, give the same directions, then that's where most of the honeybees will go. So they're, by communicating so effectively, they're very efficient. They don't waste time or waste energy going to other sites that aren't going to give them a good yield. And unfortunately, in healthcare, what I found is often our communication is inefficient. So a lot of things are done that may not have been necessary, and we aren't really coordinating our care in the way we should because of the lack of communication. And then probably the single most important thing is that the honeybee, everyone in the nest has one single goal, to accumulate honey. Now, when anybody that works in healthcare knows that everybody in healthcare does not have the same definition of honey. Some people see patient care as a way to make money, and they're mostly focused on money. Others, more altruistic, and I find the younger doctors as they first come out of medical school, are focused on improving the health and well-being of patients. And that should be our definition of honey, and everybody should have that definition. If everybody was aligned with this single goal, we could really revise our systems and everybody would agree to improve our systems with an eye toward what is the best for our patients.
That's great. Let me, if I can summarize some of the high points from the book and obviously from what you just recited. Number one, one of the overarching themes that you develop from studying bees is the need for sustainability. The hive exists so everyone can survive. And the margins of error are not really there. Everything has to work or the hive does not survive. And that includes the collection of the pollen, the honey that's made, the sustaining of the bees, the movement of the wings. It's all basically organized to allow for everyone to be sustained, or all the bees to be sustained, and for the hive to survive. But that the margins of error are actually very small. There really isn't a margin of error in terms of the activities. Two, the importance of communications. They have effective ways to communicate, both in terms of their the bees' respective responsibilities, but when there is a particular mission, et cetera. There's a shared sense of purpose within the hive. And that one of the reasons why honeybees have survived for 100 million years is that they've adopted over time for effective communications and obviously effective delegation of responsibilities, and with and to have a common purpose. More or less a fair summary, Fred.
That is. There's one other, I think, very important thing that condition that really I think is underappreciated in healthcare, and that is there is a bottom-up leadership. In other words, those on the front lines are responsible for setting the policy. Those that are higher in administration, their job should be to facilitate consensus among those on the front lines. But those who are actually directly taking care of patients, they know best what procedures, what methods need to be implemented. And too often, our systems are too top-down, and people that are sitting in offices are making decisions rather than facilitating the consensus by those on the front lines.
That's great. I was going to get into that because you had the reference to the function of the queen, which is essentially procreation, as opposed to decision making,
right?
And guiding. And I thought that was a valuable lesson. It's not just relevant to healthcare. It's relevant to the military. It's relevant to our system of education. It's relevant to the administration of our government. And I would even say, also for corporate governance and corporate affairs. So I thought that was very, very important. I should also add for the audience, Fred not only has studied honeybees and obviously successes and failures within the healthcare system and the major hospitals at large, but Fred, you have spent a fair amount of time studying the quality control, quality standards of a leading auto manufacturing company, Toyota. And maybe you can just talk a little bit about how that has influenced your thinking and also in terms of, how that leads into the book.
Yes, Toyota, as we mentioned, unlike honeybees, we are not programmed in how we behave. And one of the problems that I found, and I think everybody who's working quality and safety, is certain individuals want to always do it their way, and they don't want to accept any kind of standardized approach to procedures. And what that means is the handshakes between different individuals don't work. And one person assumes the other is doing the right thing when they're not. And so this creates a lot of errors and a lot of misdirection. So Toyota has really designed a system to motivate those that work on the assembly plant to embrace standardization and to communicate with each other in very efficient ways, and enables every individual on the front lines to suggest improvements. So they really have embraced the very things that the honeybee system has found to be important. The frontline workers really do make the changes or responsible for making the changes, and they're actually taught a way of thinking that is really the scientific method. They do what's called plan, do, study, adjust. And basically the planning is create a hypothesis, generate an experiment, a new way of doing things, try it out, see if it improves by measuring it. And then if it is an improvement, then they adjust their procedures. So what that means is the systems are continually improving. And over the 70 years that Toyota Production System has been in existence, the car manufacturing at Toyota has progressively improved. The quality of their cars, compared to the price, the quality continues to go up. The prices have been stable. So that means the value of the cars manufactured by Toyota are really among the very highest.
And I want to go back to some of the lessons for the healthcare system, but you made an important point about sort of a shared purpose, a shared job that you could observe within the hive that doesn't necessarily exist in the healthcare system. And I don't know if you're familiar with the name Peter Drucker.
I love Peter Drucker.
Okay. So Peter Drucker, one of the leading professors of business and advisors to businesses, an amazing story, basically a Holocaust survivor, immigrant to this country. Peter Drucker had a very simple and revealing question that he used to ask when he would be brought into a company that was having issues, but he would ask the CEO, what is your business? And he used to joke that if he couldn't get a straight answer the first 15 seconds, he knew what the problem was, okay? And very often, this notion of a shared job, we did a separate podcast in which this story also came up about John Kennedy when he was president. And he had already announced the ambitious moonshot, and he was touring NASA. And he saw an individual who was kind of doing maintenance type work, a bit janitorial, and he introduced himself to this gentleman and he said, so tell me, what is your job here at NASA? And the gentleman said, my job is to get a man on the moon. Now, he was not an engineer. He wasn't in the flight control center. He wasn't an astronaut. But it was interesting that no matter where he was on the, we'll call it the NASA hierarchy, his answer was that shared purpose. Everyone at NASA felt their job was to get a man on the moon. And so as you think about sort of the lesson of the hive, Fred, and then the applicability to the healthcare system, tell me what some of the changes are that can be implemented. Obviously, bottom up, better communications between everyone who's involved in patient care and lab results and things like that. But what are the things that, I'm bringing you into this brand new hospital, and we want to reduce mistakes, we want to reduce what I'll refer to as friction in the gears. We want to have a very, very efficient hospital that works for its patients as well as its staff.
Right. Yeah, my dream would be actually to start a hospital from scratch, a health system, delivery system, because one of the problems we get into is that once the culture has been established, it's very hard to change that culture. And with regards to Toyota, Toyota's really every employee is focused on creating the highest quality, most efficient production of cars that the customer will enjoy and be satisfied with. So they do also have a unified goal. So in healthcare, healthcare delivery system, the care should be truly, first of all, the number one goal. Everybody has to agree on the goal should be that it's patients over profits, that we want to improve the health and well-being of every one of our patients, and that we look through the eyes of our patient. So that should be the mantra. It's very interesting. When I trained in Boston, at Mass General and Boston City, that was the instruction that I received as a house officer, and I felt the faculty, and particularly in the Boston area, that was their number one goal. So when, yes, people did research, yes, people did other activities, but when you walked into the wards or you walked into the clinic, everything else was dropped and your total and only focus was on improving the well-being, health and well-being of your patients. That was number one, and nothing was to come between you and the patient. Now, Peter Drucker also said that culture eats strategy for breakfast. And so if your culture is focused on other things, I want to be important, I want to be the top person in this clinic or that clinic, or there's a competition between individuals, or there's a push to see more and more patients so you make more money, so you have a higher salary. Those are all that's going to really detract from the number one goal, to keep your eye on the patient and look through their eyes and try to improve their health and well-being. And that should be your only goal during the time you're on the clinic. So that's number one. And then we have to be system thinkers, and we have to, and this is where Toyota Productions comes in, we have to accept, each of us, that certain procedures, there is a best way to do things, and that we should embrace those best ways of doing things, and they should become habit. Rather than slow thinking, they will be, if you do this the same way every time, it will become fast thinking, it will become automatic, and the likelihood of error dramatically drops. It's important that your customer-supplier relationships, you understand who is providing information, who is receiving information. One of my favorites is doctor-nurse relationship, in that too often doctors think that nurses should be gratifying their ego, when in reality, the physician should be clearly describing what needs to be done to care for the patient. So their orders need to be clear, and the nurse needs to understand the goals of patient care. So that's very important. And these relationships are very, very, should be, the hierarchy needs to be very flat. If one person thinks they're much better than everybody else, you can't have effective communication, and there's no psychological safety, and people will just close down. And even though they think that what's going on is wrong, they won't say anything. So that's the other very, very important thing. And then to apply the scientific method for continued improvement. And then we have to embrace innovation. One thing that I found is, for reasons, maybe because of the way we're educated or how we got to medical school, doctors tend to want to maintain the status quo. And what we really need to all be is early adopters. We have to be eager to bring about change and continually think about improving. If we can do that, then I think we will move very much more effectively. And finally, teamwork and communication. And this is where the beehive is very impressive. The teamwork, the coordination between the worker bees, and is phenomenal. And unfortunately, too often, what I found in healthcare is that there will be a group of people that are responsible for taking care of the patient, and they will be a working group. In other words, each individual will do something for the patient, but won't communicate with each other, and will assume that that care is integrated. When in reality, what we need to do is huddle around the patient, communicate with each other, and come to a consensus on what the plan should be, with the patient in the center and with the patient agreeing and understanding what's going on. What I found is too often patients are just told what's going to be done rather than there be co-management. That is, you explain to the patient what's going on. Does this make sense to you? Do you agree with this care? The pros and cons. And patients really will weigh in and should weigh in. And I think that's very, very important as well. So there are a lot of things to do.
So Fred, first of all, this has been terrifically insightful. And if I can just add a point about embracing change and be early adopters of innovation, I'll go back to the Toyota model that you recited, which is simply being an early adopter doesn't mean you have to be a permanent adopter. You see if it works, and you alter it or change it to try to improve upon it. But the one of the lessons I took away from your book was the fact that honeybees have been around for over 100 million years. You don't hang around for more than 100 million years unless you are sort of embracing the need for change and adopting to the environment. And obviously the hive operates in a changing environment. The hive doesn't control the environment. And I took that to be an important lesson as we think about the administration of healthcare. It has to be responsive to change circumstances, and we certainly saw that during the pandemic, and obviously I sort of got to be a firsthand witness to how you were constantly seeking information and seeking to give people and organizations the most up-to-date information about a fast-changing situation that was affecting, you know, everyone in the world and the economy and national security as well. So I'll give you the final 60 seconds or so, just on that point alone. And obviously it ties into people feeling they have a stake in it and they have a unified purpose in operating there. But, you know, in terms of some of the changes that are needed that you highlighted in the book, maybe you can just sort of close on the note of how to get those ideas implemented.
Well, yeah, thank you, David. The during COVID-19, New York suffered the most massive influx of patients and really did not have time, I don't think, to design its systems to deal with the massive influx of very, very sick patients. But fortunately, in our system, I'm in the Division of Hospital Medicine now. We were responsible for caring for all COVID-19 patients. So I was able to apply the principles that we've described here. And what we did is to enhance communication, we had a town hall meeting with all the hospitalists every week. And I was continually, being an infectious disease specialist, I was continually looking at the literature, analyzing the data. And because I'd been an editor of a journal, the Journal of Infectious Disease, I was able to sift through and determine what I thought was most accurate and most scientifically the strongest evidence we had, and made educated guesses based on that knowledge. And then I shared this information with our hospitalists. So we all wanted to take the best possible care. We standardized the care. We had a special order set. We had a special template for evaluating our patients, so we knew we could assess the severity of patients. And then we, based on the severity, we implemented different treatments. What was very exciting is that I know in New York, a fair number of nurses and doctors quit and burned out. We didn't have, among our 50 hospitalists, not a single hospitalist took a day off for mental health, and nobody quit. And everybody actually got through this challenge. Actually, there were three big waves of COVID-19, actually four big waves of COVID-19 patients. And they were all very frightening because we didn't know what the volume would be. But because we worked together, because we continually communicated, we were able to get through this with flying colors. So, and that just shows you how a healthcare system and how a group of people, if they really communicate effectively and work together in a very coordinated fashion, can overcome unexpected challenges.
Fred, this has been, as anticipated, a great conversation. I'll note that your book is a top bestseller on Amazon in the healthcare field. Congratulations not only on the book, but certainly a sincere note of gratitude for writing this. And I'm hoping that, you know, people will continue to listen to you, whether it's from the Journal of Infectious Diseases or with this book. A lot to be done, and you know, I thank you for really working outside the box to improve the healthcare for everyone here in the United States. So thanks again for this public service.
Well, thank you, David. I really appreciate being able to talk to you about my favorite subject.
Okay, don't get stung out there. It's a very divisive world, Fred.
Over the time, I've learned how to anticipate stings and prevent them from happening. And that's one of the skill sets you need to develop, actually, that I finally developed after multiple stings.
There you go. All right. Thanks again, Fred. And I look forward to resuming our conversation more broadly around everything from COVID to the emerging infectious diseases. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This is the RAIN Insights podcast, which is part of the RAIN Insights series comprised of both virtual and real-world events, offering unique practical perspectives from RAIN's leading experts in risk management. To learn more, please visit us at rainnetwork.com. That's RANE network.com. Thank you for listening.